DFW, Washington.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Black Studies at the Conjuncture, Crisis, Lineage, and Rupture. Africa Now is next.
Mutual aid, the act of taking care of each other, comes in many forms. One such form is supporting WPFW. At a time when so many are hurting, if you are doing well financially and want to do good, we invite you to give the gift of WPFW. Emancipatory media is truly the gift that keeps on giving. A tax-deductible donation can be made anytime at WPFWFM.org or from Sunday, December 14th through Saturday, December 20th during our pledge drive by calling 800-222-9739. It is your continued support that allows us to do the work of building a more equitable world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to Sharmuiza Muntali. The music in the background is Drum Song by Earth, Wind & Fire, and we play that remembering Earth, Wind & Fire's founder and leader, Maurice White's birthday, which is December 19. Before that, you heard the voice of our program director, Katia Stitt, reminding us about the importance of mutual aid, reminding us to support the gift that keeps on giving 24/7, your community radio station for over 48 years, WPFW. First, I just want to thank the listeners for supporting Don't Forget the Blues with Clarence the Bluesman Turner today during our end of the year pledge drive. Being solidarity with WPFW and Africa Now, our goal for this hour is $500. Call today, the only day for Africa Now for the end of the year pledge drive. Call at 202-588-9739 or visit WPFWFM.org or on our Cash App, which is the $ WPFWFM, so that we can reach our goal of $500 and hopefully beyond. It's your generosity that allows us to continue this tradition of expansive, emancipatory excellence in community radio. As the year comes to an end, we ask you to once again be in solidarity with WPFW during our end of the year pledge drive today by donating at WPFWFM.org or by calling 202-588-9739. Again, the number is 202-588-9739 or on our Cash App, which is the $ WPFWFM. And that would enable us to reach our goal and hopefully go beyond our goal. Today we feature a discussion, part of a one-day conference entitled Black Studies at the Conjuncture, Crisis, Lineage, and Rapture, which took place in October at Brown University. The discussion with Dr. Joshua M. Myers unpacked the past, present, and the future of Black Studies and potential responses to moments of emergency and upheaval. Dr. Joshua M. Myers is Associate Professor of Africana Studies in the Afro-American Studies Department at Howard University, and he is a member of Africa Now's and Africa World Now Projects Collective and author of the book of Black Study. Here is Dr. Joshua M. Myers.
Just a quick circle back to that, but that's all I'm thinking about. And the long journey of Black people dealing with the question of the blues, which is what I heard in this morning's panel. Even though nobody, I don't think anybody said the word blues, but that's what I heard. That's how it resonated with me. as someone who is paying attention to the ways that all black people deal with negativity, to build a particular kind of relation to the world that doesn't show up in the political. If you were to ask them, this is just the blues, which doesn't necessarily resolve itself into a kind of neat and cogent political framework that we might even call liberation. There's no guarantee of that, right? And I think about D'Angelo, because there was no guarantee that he would create. In fact, his life was in many ways defined by the demand that he created and his refusal to accede to that demand and create differently, create in different times, literally both in music theory and in terms of how we expected him or wanted him to show up. He says, I refuse. And to me, that becomes a lesson for not just what it means to have a relationship to the outside world, but also what it means to come when the time is right for you and for us, and the experience that guides what it means to be a vessel, as he would say, for a time horizon and a political horizon and a musical horizon that in some ways has to be disrupted for the blues to really live and for the blues to really make sense. And I'm still unsure about that. I don't know what it means to be sure about what D'Angelo meant. And I'm also okay with that. Because when he said that I'm doing this because I'm a conduit and a vessel for a black music, I understood that that means potentially that us minimizing our egos, minimizing our maybe individual genius in service to something is all the lesson that we might need in this moment. And so if you were to ask D'Angelo what he was doing before, it wasn't for soup for stardom, it wasn't for attention, and it wasn't for money and fame and wealth and all the things that are supposed to be the provisions given to the folks who have that much talent. Who was sending him? What was sending him? It's the question of who was sending us to do black study. And what is sending us to do black study. So that's what I'm thinking about. But I'm also happy to be here at Brown, because there's so many people that I know here, so many people that I love and respect here in this room. I'm not gonna call all the names, but you know who you are. I'm so happy to be here. I was telling Brian Meeks that I come here every year. Maybe not to the campus, but I come to Providence every year. For the last decade or so, I usually stay here when I go down to Newport Jazz Festival. And so I'm no stranger to this space, to the city, and to this area of the country, because it's really weird relationship to Newport and the jazz scene there and all of the things that happen. And I say it's weird because we don't necessarily control that, even though the music itself is ours, right? And so I also was just here in spring 2024, the sociology department hosted me, and I actually read from, not black composition, but I read from a book that I think I'm interested in maybe workshopping with some of you all here, that I'm tentatively titling After the State, because I'm already thinking about this could be on the state. And let's think about what the vision would be for after that happens. And so, yes, I'm happy to be here, and Justina, I think what you said, both of which, how you opened so beautiful, but what you said about the classroom might be the only value that matters to me. There are a lot of writers. But to me, teaching is the thing. And it's the only reason to really have a relationship to the academy at this point, is to do what we did in the classroom together. So thank you for that. But will it continue? Can it continue? Should we be surprised that we're under threat? I'm not surprised. I understand what it means to be under constant surveillance because I teach at Howard University. And what we do in light of that is continue to do what we do until somebody says stop, and then we continue to do it. Right? In other words, their power over us, their ability to threaten us, it's not going to stop the show. And the question that we have to develop is, how do we continue to cultivate the capacity to still go when they say you can't? And I'm not in a mode of prescribing what that looks like for everybody, right? But I'm not concerned about whether or not they can tell me to stop and whether or not they will, because they will. In fact, if they are not threatening me, it means I'm not doing something right. They're not threatening us. Perhaps we've been incorporated. So I'm thinking about June, and I'm thinking about what it means to June Jordan. And I'm thinking about also what it means to think about this as a family affair, the restoration, if you will, of an ethic of familiality, not just familiarity. I think about Tiffany Willoughby-Gerard, who, for those who may not have known her before, we came to know her in spring of 2024, when she talked about what kind of future is possible, right, for her students if a police force can tell them, control them, contain them on campus. And they asked her when she worried about her career, not worried about my career. But Tiffany said something very simple to me once about the state of the academy, Tiffany in Black Studies. And this may have been 3 years ago, like a year before, you know, she went viral, I guess. Of course, she wasn't trying to go viral. But she said, my colleagues don't know my children. The people that I go to work with every day don't even know my children's names. That's not the kind of Black Studies I want. Right, so when Jordan talks about family, I'm thinking about that, right? But she's also thinking about family in the context of resisting the kind of person the university makes us. A person, or notion of personhood that's habituated to the terror and perpetuating the terror as scholars in whatever way that is, right? That first part of that article, bringing back the person, where she talks about what the university is preparing us to do, right, and be. And what I heard with Tiffany's injunction was that actually, this makes sense, as you grew up in a place like Orangeburg, South Carolina, where I grew up, where there's two HBCUs, South Carolina State University and Classroom. And if you go up there, somebody mama gonna be there. Somebody daddy gonna be there, and you gonna know who they are. And if something happens, you know that you can trust them. If you're hungry, you know that you can find food. This is an HBCU that's under threat, constantly by the state of South Carolina. How did they create family despite that? And as a Black, someone who studied Black radicalism, I was very critical of the conservatism of those spaces. And also, somebody up there fed me once, prayed for me once, made sure I had what I needed, actually saved me from drowning once. I mean, who are these people? And what kind of, as Erica Edwards said, what kind of tradition is this for real? Even if it's beyond the legal tradition, right? June Jordan gives us language, I think, for that, for understanding that, and also understanding how we should inhabit the spaces that we are in, even though we know that we're not supposed to be there forever. I resonate with Erica Edwards, and she says that we are passing through. This ain't gonna be permanent. So if you're passing through, how are you gonna move through? If you know that you're passing through, what then do you want this space to be as you're passing through? And what might it not be? And I think that's where I came up with the idea of resisting the lies. Because one of the lies was, we were here to diversify the university permanently. That was never the plan for that created Black Studies. Right? And so, lastly, I'll just say that I'm interested in struggling alongside graduate students. I am not interested in advising graduate students. And that goes for me, that goes to not just how we organize, also how we write. How we engage text, how we engage ideas, how we engage the practice of research. It has to be a collaborative effort. It has to be a collective effort. We have to get rid of the inherent hierarchies of graduate student training if we're going to be free. That model does not work if the objective is liberation. And so, that being said, with the gathering together, the journal that Justina mentioned that I edited, we are actually coming together in a couple of weeks to bring more graduate students into this process of thinking about how your writing can be the thing that gets you outside of the normative function of the academic training model, and how to struggle on the page with these ideas, and as you saw exemplified, but also what that means for genre, for form, for creativity, for what kind of writing we might do that makes our continued existence in these spaces where we should be passing through justified in the first place. Because if we're doing the writing that makes us just another run-of-the-mill academic, that's also not why my studies was created. So thank you for the conversation, and I'm ready to get more into it, more of a conversation.
So much. I want to talk about organizing in Black study for a little bit. And so I want to think about, when I think about my own trajectory, I can literally remember the books and the professors who were responsible for my radicalization. Like, I can remember it. I can remember what it felt like to come into college. I'm from PG, so coming into college, you train to love Obama, you're a Democrat, like, all of those things, and yet I walked out. And yet, you know, my parents thought I was going to go to law school. Like, there was a very specific trajectory mapped out for me, and I came out studying my identity in a communist. I really want us to talk about how the field is able to transform people in that type of way. Yeah. And it's not, to me, it's not just the text. Mm-hmm. It's that relationship to teaching and to Black study and to like what you really want to see out of your student. Mm-hmm. And so on our phone conversation, we talked about different generations of Black studies are bringing something different that we need to reckon with. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about, are we at a moment of Black studies where the type of education that I received, the transforming education, is that done?
Yeah. It's the classroom as a site. Once again, Julia Lusso is here. Love you, Julia, because you keep us grounded in a way that helps us remember what we were doing in the first place. And I say that because I'm thinking about the convening that we had in Washington, D.C. this summer, co-facilitated by Jaree, myself, and two Brown graduates, Felicia Dino and Badura Lagra, around how to teach the movement in this moment, right? The 60s iteration of the movement, but we know that the 60s iteration of the movement is not sui generis, that it actually is connected to larger valences of Black struggle. But how do you actually go into a classroom in a university right now and explore that in a way that shows that students, you are actually part of this genealogy, this continuity, this ability to take the world that you have and then transform it for the better for your people in conversation with other folk, right? And so the classroom has to be a side of that. But what we explored this summer was that the methods that we are getting to do this in a way that transforms you, Monet, are not being taught to graduate students, number one, and are not being absorbed by their experiences in most university spaces. We're borrowing pedagogical methods from Sunday schools, from freedom schools, from community organizing spaces. We're actually inviting a kind of community, as Jordan says, right? That is usually outside of the gate of the academy. But we're inviting them into the space of instruction. And so when you take your intro class, it should immediately be clear, this is not like any other class. Not just in terms of what I'm learning, but the type of community I'm getting that allows me to see myself as connected to something larger than myself, but also now I gotta figure out how to make this the whole world, because this little part of this ain't gonna be sufficient, right? This is one class. This needs to be the whole world, not the whole university, right? The Yoruba would say the world is a classroom.
Again, that's Dr. Joshua M. Myers, who's unpacking the past, present, and the future of Black studies and potential responses to moments of emergency and upheaval. And we're playing that as part of the topic, Black studies at the conjuncture, crisis, lineage, and rapture. Again, you're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. And Dr. Josh Myers is Associate Professor of Africana Studies in Afro-American Studies Department at Howard University. And if he sounds familiar to you folks, and he's a member of Africa Now's and Africa Will Now Project's collective and author of the book of Black Study. And as you know, we're in the midst of our end of the year pledge drive, and to reach our goal today of $500, you can call 202-588-9739. Again, the number is 202-588-9739. Or you can also go to the website at wpfwfm.org. That's wpfwfm.org. Scroll down to Africa Now and make your pledge there. And you can also go to our Cash App, which is the $WPFWFM. And that's the Cash App is the $WPFWFM. And also you can text at 801-801-WPFWFM on texting. And again, as we said, you know, the theme of the fund drive is mutual aid, as you heard at the beginning, Katia Stitt on the PSA reminding us of the importance of mutual aid. And that's actually been really the tenets and how PFW has been here for the last 48 years, because the community has always been there supporting it in times of need, has made sure that the station stays on the air, made sure that also that the station is independent. That the station is always speaking truth to power. And just like this, the show you're listening to today and others throughout the day and the weeks are providing information which you would not regularly hear on the so-called mainstream media. And this one in particular, looking at Black studies, particularly at this particular time when there's been an assault on history and the truth, and especially issues concerning African peoples worldwide. We thought this important discussion, which was held actually in October at Brown University, where Dr. Myers was speaking at the conference, Black Studies at the Conjuncture, Crisis, Lineage, and Rupture. And we still, our goal, as I mentioned, was $500. We've shrunk it a bit. We still have $180 to go. I just want to thank Sonetta from Gaithersburg. Thank you very much for your support. And I just want to also thank Charles and Isabel. I know those folks, those are my parents. Thank you very much for your support. And the Charles and Isabel, Kensington, Maryland, thank you very much for your support as well. And thank you, Sonetta, as well. And if you want to join the three people who have supported so far, and there's actually one other supporter, which I can't see, the supporter, but hopefully later on we'll get the information about that, the person who supported us. Go on the website at WPFWFM.org, scroll down to Africa Now, and also you can go to the phone and dial 800-222-9739. That's 800-222-9739 or 202-588-9739. And again, you can go to the Cash App, which is the $WPFWFM. We're going to go back to the conversation with Josh Myers of Africa World Now Project Collective and Africa Now.
And so the experimentation that we do, and I like to use the word experimentation because, again, it's not solidified, right? We haven't created a formula. In fact, Justina would tell you what it was like to take my course in person, then take it virtually. I'm like, we're still trying to figure this out. But it is a way of being that captures something profound about how we are heirs to people who knew what it meant to take care of children, people who knew what it meant to deal with the environment, people who knew how to solve problems. We're not bereft of that, right? And so the classroom is just another site of experimenting about how to live, how we might live, what might come next. And that's how it should feel for the students. And that's why it felt different for you. But you're right. Is there a shift now, right? Because one of the reasons that it was given to me that way was because our professors were equally adept at giving a lecture, but also showing up at Sankofa, one of our liberated spaces in DC, and running a PE class, right? Or political education class, not physical education. Right? Some of y'all who've been a part of a PE process know it's a different type of learning. But it's not as stated or as static as what it would be if you were at a 250-seat course in an auditorium, right? But they brought that same energy. And so I was trained by organizers in Africana studies on campuses. And if that wasn't sufficient, and sometimes it wasn't, we would literally open up spaces. Lawrence Giai gave a lecture in my Intro to Africana Studies class in 2006, right? Bob Brown gave a lecture in my Introduction to Afro-American Studies. I'm talking about as a student. And so I'm seeing my professors like, this person is going to give me a grade, right? But then he's like inviting Lawrence Giai to talk about something that is central to understanding our story. And I realized that that particular method comes out of a deep respect for organizing spaces, but also this is an extension of that in the classroom. And it recalls that this was done before, right? Sterling Brown used to do this at Howard University. And I've been telling this story probably at everything that I've been doing for the last couple of years. But one semester, I guess it must have been late 50s, maybe even earlier than that, he was asked to teach American literature. And during that time, you know, you had to teach it straight. All right? So I got to take you through, you know, Steinbeck, and, you know, I got to take you through, you know, the so-called canon. He gets to the last week of the lecture, I mean, the last week of the semester, and he's like, I know y'all tired of this stuff. It's the 50s, so it's not like, you know, people were, you know, at Howard. It's not like people were on fire, right? There's a reason the mayor Barata left. What is this? But he invites, this is American literature class, all right? He invites Willie the Lion Smith to give a lecture. Now, for those who don't know, Willie the Lion Smith was perhaps one of the most inventive, experimental, but also very clearly engaged in the tradition of ragtime jazz pianists of that era. But he was an elder by then. And so the question is raised, like, what the hell does this guy have to do with American literature? And Sutton Brown introduces him. He says, if literature is supposed to be or reflect something essential or meaningful about human life, then there's nobody more qualified to talk about black life than somebody like Willie the Lion Smith. Throw the books away. Here's your introduction to a real life legend, a real life tale, a real life narration of what it means to be a black person. And guess what the students remember from that semester? They didn't remember Steinbeck. Perhaps they did, because, you know, Sutton Brown was known to be a harsh writer. But everybody that took that class talks about Willie the Lion Smith. That's the difference in life service.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you for that question. When you said this needs to be the whole world, like, that is exactly what being in certain classrooms at Howard felt like.
Yeah.
Like being in your classroom at Howard felt like.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
and then you go out to the yard and there's like other things happening there.
Yeah.
Or you go into your poli sci classes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to take Constitution at his word. Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah. It's just, it has me thinking about, there's so much affect and so much intimacy in what you just described.
Yeah.
And what we all experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about coming to a place like Brown and understanding that not everybody gets that experience.
Yeah.
Not everybody has that behind them. Not everybody knows what that feeling is like and can carry it with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to ask you to zoom in for a moment. When you get to a moment where you hit a wall, where you're told no, where you're told to stop,
yeah,
and you do it anyway.
Right.
What does that feel like? What is that like? How is that done? Because I think that's something that I need to remember how to do. But also I think that this is a moment where everyone in Black Studies needs to figure out how to do that, regardless of what their experiences have been.
Yeah. So two things in general, right? One is knowing how to break a rule, right? And the second is thinking, well, let me start with the breaking the rule part. So for me, I get told no at Howard all the time. And I realize why, right? I realize where or how I'm positioned. And quite frankly, even the more well-known professors who Howard should in fact be, if they had any, you know, sense, promoting as the ethos of the university, they also get told no, right? And so for me, it's knowing how to break the rules. I figured out that if you're going to get any work done, understanding that you have accountability from the community to contend with. I got an answer to Jareed too, right? There's a lot of people I got to answer to. I got to answer to Karen Spellman, who's, you know, another Howard grad, but connected to the SNCC project as well, SNCC Legacy Project, but also to the legacy of organizing the SNCC, right? I position myself knowing that I'm never going to be the so-called star, right? Howard will never make me a star. Howard will always tell me no. So guess what I then do? If I want to do the work for real, I never allow them to give me permission. I don't ask. If I want to build, if I want a room, I take it, right? If I want to bring somebody to campus, I do it, right? And sometimes that means you have to go without some of the resources that we should be afforded. But also, their resources come with another associated cost. Now they know what you're doing. Now they can say, deny you, right? And so, I now learned how to student organize. I didn't learn this, you know, as a faculty member. By the time I was a faculty member 4 years later, it was like, yeah, I'm avoiding that office, because that's where the red tape is, that's where the ignorant person is, that's where the conservative is, that's where the sexist is, that's where the person who don't like black people is. All right, who do I need to not have to ask permission to do something on campus. So that's the first thing that, you know, I kind of established in my practice, that if you are asking them, they can then, they have power, right? Because they can tell you no. Now, associated with that is the second part, and that is, even if Howard came against us, they know that it's not going to be just individual professors that they can pick off. And so what we've done, while we have while some of us have avoided direct confrontation in terms of asking for permission, is we've cultivated a base in the community that at the very moment there's an assault against us, they're going to at least have to work hard to get rid of us. No one's going to say that they can't accomplish it, but now they have to work harder. They have to actually confront not just individual professors, not just a student organization, not just an alumni network, because they know how to handle that. But what they can't handle is 500 brothers from Southeast coming up on campus saying, all right, we know Josh. Right? And sure, they'll call the cops, they'll call the police. But one thing about being, what I learned in D.C. is, black folks aren't afraid of that. And even if we don't win, quote unquote, it's a moment of hesitation, which I write about in the book, that allows us to figure out what the next step would be. And so while they are contending with the fact that they just can't beat us easily, we don't figure out what we're going to do that exceeds and invades their whole apparatus. And that's where, you know, being in the community, being connected to what's happening in the streets, which is a Black Studies principle that I hold dear, that's where it shows up in these moments of upheaval. One of the reasons that we have lasted almost, we just celebrated 50 years in 2019, so we're coming up on 60 years in 2029. We've lasted that long at Howard because they know it ain't just us. We only got 8 professors. They know it's not just us. They know it's not just our alum. They know it's not, no, they know it's a larger community, not just in D.C., but in the whole Pan-African world. And so, again, that's not to say that they can't defeat us or they can't remove us. It's just going to be harder because we have people. And those people are what gives me not only the inspiration, whatever legitimacy I have doesn't come from the institution, it comes from them. In some ways, I've been ready to leave, but I can't leave because they like, all right, you got to stay. I'm going to send my son to college. Okay. I'll stay. Okay. But, and it's small variations of that, right? Hearing Justina today, it's like, all right, I got to stay another couple years now because Justina said that. Right? And so the legitimacy comes from people who are not only invested in, you know, the academic, you know, legitimization practices, right? They don't care if I got tenure or not. Are you there? Right? And so I got tenure so I can stay there. But it's like, they don't even know what tenure really fully means. They are saying, you're there because we need somebody in that position. We need somebody to be able to connect, you know, what's happening there to what's happening down here. And again, that doesn't mean that it's permanent. Because conditions change on the ground all the time. At some point, the needs of the community might be, all right, we don't need y'all to be at Howard no more. We need y'all to be at Duke Ellington School of the Arts. Or we need y'all, right now, Dunbar High School in D.C. has a Black Studies program. Like, we need to be ready and prepared to answer the call if somebody says, the real struggle is going to happen in the high schools now. Are we willing to take ourselves in those spaces and do it? Like, that's where being connected to the community leads us. It leads us to places that don't look like the so-called academic journey that we've been told is the only journey, right? I was in, Durham, North Carolina a couple weeks ago. And it was for a music festival where we got to sit down talking with the musicians and the artists. And they're like, how do we pull more of you all out to come with us on the road? And this isn't like glamour, we're talking about jazz artists. So we're not talking about being on the road with like Beyonce. We're talking about people who like literally have to pay for their own travel.
Again, that's Josh M. Myers, Associate Professor of Africana Studies in the Afro-American Studies Department at Howard University. And he's also a member of Africa Nows and Africa World Now Projects Collective, talking about the Black Studies. And in there, he also mentioned about the importance of community. And joining me in the community today is James Pope, who's here. I think he's on. Is he on? No, I guess he's going to be on soon. James Pope is the executive producer and co-host of Africa Now. But the importance of community, he's coming on now. And the importance of community is really what WPFW is all about. It's because of the community that we exist and we've been on since 1977. And there's James Pope, our co-host and also executive producer of Africa Now, and of course, I have the Africa World Now Project Collective. As you know, we're talking about community, and you're as a professor as well. What Joshua has just been talking about, the importance of not just being in the ivory towers, but actually taking the information, working with people in the community, learning from the community, not just teaching community, but actually learning with the community.
No, absolutely. That's been the tradition and also a requirement in the context of Africana studies, Black folk learning and creating knowledge about themselves and about the world and how they fit into it. We spend a lot of time trying to connect the dots find the continuities and study it, present it as a platform to engage and invite people as a point of entry to think about the world more deeply. And this is what you're getting with this particular program, with all of the many hats that we juggle, all of the many things that we attempt to do. And, you know, we do spend time doing this. We do spend time, you know, Josh is part of the collective, spends time thinking, lending his time and his access to different resources and different communities to think about this stuff, you know, that we're thinking about and presenting to you as points of entry. Again, these are not the end all, but these are points of entry for extension, expansion into practice. And also, as me people say, theory, how do we create the world that we want to live in?
And if you want to join the community, I shouldn't say if you want to join the community, to reaffirm your membership of the community, you call 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or go on the website, wpfwfm.org, and scroll down to Africa Now. That's wpfwfm.org. And of course, the Cash App is the $WPFWFM. And I know we have people from all over the world, so they'll be making a donation on the website. We have just a little bit to go. We can make this goal. We exceed the goal. The goal was $500. We only need $180, and we have
$180.
That's it. I know you have some rich friends, James, over there.
Let me tell you
one thing. You're out there in Virginia, so yes.
We'll be broadcasting from Mars at this point. You know, or we'll be doing what we're doing.
Yeah. I know you got some folks out there in the community, in the village, that wants to make sure that this child of theirs succeeds, goes on to bigger and brighter things, make sure that it makes the 50-year mark. We're 49, almost 49 years in February. So I know
49 years is a long time.
49 years, yeah. That's a tremendous achievement. And as we're talking about the community, as Joshua was talking about community, also reminded me, PFW lives up to that mantra that we have to come to the community to get our creds, to get reaffirmed, to be us, to be accountable for everything that we do. We're accountable to the community. We're not accountable to corporations and, you know, millionaires and things like that we're accountable to people working daily, hard work daily. Sorry, James, you're saying.
Let me extend this notion of community, right? We're talking about a community extended and in a community in tradition and genealogy. So when we're talking about community, we're talking about a long tradition of folk who have made it possible for us to sit here, for us to engage in conversation, for us to think together, to create space again, to think about the future, to create the future. As Thomas Sankara once said, we need to be mad. You have to have a certain level of madness, to create the future, to create something that isn't seen, but you feel it, to merge those worlds of seen and unseen. And in thinking about the work that we put in, I'm running from one meeting to another.
Yeah, my literally, son,
sitting in
that's
his,
what he was doing. Yeah,
sitting in his kitchen in his apartment, like call my son. Hey, I got to jump on the radio real quick. So I stopped by his place. I'm on the radio on my way to another meeting. You know what I mean? So, this is the type of commitment. So when we're talking about commitment, and we're talking about community and creating, there's a commitment to each one of the programmers that each component of WPFW for over 49 years, going into 50 years. Are committed to bringing, a level of deep thinking, and also encouraging us to practice. I just want to put a little call out for all of our Black capitalist folk who want to circulate that dollar. Go ahead and circulate that dollar, here. This is one of the opportunities for you to do that. Black capitalism, of course, is a contradiction, but we don't want to get into that. But the point being is that let's circulate those dollars here. If that's what you intend to do, go ahead and, practice what you preach. With this particular entity here.
Again, the number is 202-588-9739 or on the website wpfwfm.org. Scroll down to Africa Now, make your support for Africa Now. And then on the Cash App is the $ WPFWFM. And make sure on the memo line you write that it's for Africa Now. Unfortunately, we won't be able to thank you because we won't see it until after the show. But just thanking, want to remember the folks who have already donated. Sonetta at Gaithersburg, thank you very much. Thanks for all your continued support throughout the years. And Charles and Isabel, who are, of course, they're my parents, who have supported us. Thank you very much.
Let me call my parents.
And then there's one other person we can't see on the line, but they've also supported us. We only have $180 to go. We're going to play a little bit of the discussion by Josh Myers, unpacking Black studies and community, and particularly at this urgent time.
So I'm going to pilot some of this in the spring. We'll be in conversation with the musician, then the musician performs. So people like me will be in conversation talking about the link between music and radicalism, talking about the link between this sound and the political address that's embedded in it, that a lot of the people who go to experience music don't even recognize is happening. But to the artists, when they don't recognize it, the misrecognition forces a disjuncture between the provision of the name and the ability to produce it in a way that it should be produced. Musicians know what I'm talking about, right? When the audience isn't with you, it shapes how you can be in that space and share that thing. And so how do you clear the space, in other words? And so what I'm saying is that there are ways of being in community with this larger kind of thrust of like Black study that don't always look like, all right, I gotta go get a teen track professorship. And I'm also not talking about this kind of alt-act stuff, like alt-academic movement. I'm talking about actual community with Black folk doing the work. That can take you to many places. And so the idea of someone saying, I can't do this, or telling me no, I'm like, y'all don't even know who I am. Y'all don't know who we are. And y'all don't know what's happening that's so beyond this very narrow and limited academic conversation that actually is going to have you reckon with us at some point. But I'm not concerned about you. And we've never been concerned about you. We're just passing through.
Talking about, I'm not invested in morality. In a lot of ways, I think morality is anti-Black. But I do have investment in principles, and I do have investment in an ethical posture. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of what you're talking about is a type of ethical posture that you get when you come through Black studies, or you get when you come through a particular type of Black organizing. Like, it's something you can kind of smell on people where you're just like, I know what you are. Like, and I probably know who trained you. Right. And I'm just wondering, you know, maybe we can talk a little bit about what we really think the Obama era did to Black study and Black studies, mm-hmm. and where we think we are in the divide between the people who exhibit some of that ethical posture and people who kind of have more of the university in them, whether they know it or not.
Yeah.
And I'm just really interested in how we talk about that internal struggle that is happening in movement spaces and in the academy. We don't agree on anything. Joy James says we've lost all meaning of all our words. She straight up said everything. Like, she's gesturing us to a type of liberal capture that is like the absence presence of all of our spaces. And how do we push against that? Because I know people right now who are like, we don't care if the university tells us stop. We won't do it. We won't answer the Empire question. We won't do the encampments. We won't do the path. We won't do it until we get from out.
Right.
But when that's only two niggas, and then 10 more niggas get to keep their jobs and they spot.
Yeah. So, I mean, look.
These ideas that I'm presenting, first of all, they were given to me. They're not my ideas. Secondly, if you think it's easy to be in this individual posture, it's not. It's not. Like, I was socialized to be the other thing too. I actually taught in the McNair program at Temple University, which is how to be a professional student, then professional academic, right? Thankfully, I avoided Bella Mays. Y'all know what I'm talking about. But my students have it. And so I'm hearing all kinds of nonsense coming out of people who are socialized to be, for lack of a better term.
Again, that's Joshua Myers. He is Associate Professor of Africana Studies in the Afro-American Studies Department at Howard University, and he's been unpacking the past, present, and the future of Black studies and the potential responses to moments of emergency and upheaval. The full conversation will be on our SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. And as we were talking about community, I just want to thank folks in our community, Funangonda and also Chanda Kozer for all the continued support in the Africa World Now Project Collective. And of course, Josh Myers is part of the Africa World Now Project Collective. So
yeah, you're talking about community, and plus he has a program on WPFW.
Yeah, and he has a program on WPFW. Yes, he has a man of many hats.
And I just wanted to make sure as we kind of part and just posit this very, very important. They are attacking Black studies programs. I'm in North Carolina. There is literal things that are happening. I want people to pay attention to that. And if you're not clear about those, then you can come here, deal with. There's a sustained conversation that you find with Africa Now and Africa World Now Project and our collective that are thinking about the bridge between what we're producing in the context of non-institutional space, with, you know, obviously beyond the university and spaces such as this, and also the things that we also do. Be clear, be intentional, and be aware. It is not, and we have to fight as a united front against this fascist contingency, this iteration of it, I will say.
Again, call 202-588-9739. We still have $180 to go to make our goal of $500. Again, the number is 202-588-9739. Or go on the website at wpfwfm.org. Scroll down to Africa Now and make your donation there. And of course, you can go on our WhatsApp, which is the $WPFWFM. Thanks, James Pope, the co-host and executive producer of Africa Now. And up next is Headline News, followed by with Shewanana, Zain Alamin, and that's followed by the Women's Collective, Sophie's Parlor. And again, we're going to leave you with a song from Earth and the Fire, Africano, as we continue to celebrate Maurice White's birthday, the leader of Earth and the Fire. Have a great day, have a great week, and stay safe.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, December 17th. Here are some headlines. President Trump yesterday expanded the list of countries with full or partial travel restrictions to 20 primarily Muslim-majority nations. The revised policy fully blocks travel for individuals from Syria, South Sudan, Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, and also for people with documents issued by the Palestinian Authority. Partial travel restrictions will be applied to individuals from 15 additional countries, predominantly in Africa, as well as to Caribbean nations, Antigua and Barbuda and Dominica. Trump has argued the restrictions are necessary to protect national security and public safety. The number of countries with full or partial travel restrictions to the United States is now 39, up from 19 earlier. The new restrictions go into effect on January 1st. In more news, last week a drone strike in Sudan killed six Bangladeshi peacekeepers serving with the UN's interim security forces. WPFW's Noah Portner has this report.
A drone strike on December 13th struck a logistics base in South Kordofan, marking one of the deadliest single attacks on UN personnel since the conflict began. The six killed were all Bangladeshi nationals, with eight others also wounded in the attack. The UN Secretary General condemned it as a possible war crime. Bangladesh held a funeral ceremony on December 15th as the bodies of the fallen were repatriated. Other nations, including Egypt and the USA, reiterated calls for a ceasefire. The Sudanese military, meanwhile, blamed the paramilitary rapid support forces for the strike, part of months of intense fighting between these two factions that has devastated nearly all of Western Sudan. The violence has compounded an already dire humanitarian crisis, especially the lack of adequate food and shelter. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
In more news, yesterday President Trump ordered a total and complete naval blockade on all sanctioned oil tankers entering or leaving Venezuelan waters, part of an escalating campaign to pressure President Nicolas Maduro's government. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
The U.S. government is blockading Venezuela over alleged terrorism and drug trafficking, although the economic implications and Venezuela's massive oil reserves cannot be ignored. The move follows the recent U.S. seizure of a Venezuelan-linked oil tanker last week and the imposition of sanctions on Venezuelan companies and vessels. Analysts say that the blockade has left millions of barrels of crude oil stranded at sea, with only the U.S.-owned company, Chevron, still exporting under a special U.S. license. Chevron is the only major U.S. oil company operating in Venezuela. Caracas has denounced the blockade as a grotesque threat and a violation of international law, while allies like Cuba have condemned the U.S. actions. The European Union has also recently extended its sanctions on Venezuelan officials through 2027, reinforcing broader international pressure tied to human rights. Aside from these humanitarian concerns, however, is the fact that Venezuela has the world's largest proven oil reserves, more even than Saudi Arabia. Also, over half of this oil is exported to China, the USA's major geopolitical rival. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
You're listening to a program previously aired on WPFW. While this is not a live broadcast, we're proud to bring you this encore presentation filled with the same insight.